This week on The Score, will independent candidates for the state Senate overcome the odds to win in November? Can a first-year college student take on the FDA and change federal policy? What can we make of Donald Trump's challengers in the Republican presidential primaries? All this and more on The Score, so don't go away.
You're listening to The Score from Bering Drift with your host, Rick Sincere.
Welcome back to The Score from Bering Drift. I'm your host, Rick Sincere. This week's guests are all younger than 30 years old, but each one is aiming to have an impact on politics and policy. We'll start out talking to a couple of candidates for the Virginia General Assembly, then hear from the teenage co-founder of a nonprofit advocacy group, and wrap up our conversation from last week about the 2020 presidential primary candidates. First in line is Waylon Ross, who at 29 years old is running for the Virginia General Assembly in the 16th State Senate District. The seat is open, but he is an independent in a race against former Democratic delegate Joe Morrissey, whose notoriety and bank account give him an edge. Or do they? I spoke to Waylon after a candidates forum in Charlottesville on September 24th. What motivated you to run in the 16th Senate District?
Well, what motivated me to run is I wanted to give a blueprint for my peers to get involved in politics, and I would want to encourage them to actually run themselves, even if it's against me. That's what motivated me to run for office, but specifically for this race, Senate District, I think that that is the place where I can affect, where I can impact the most change, is the most visible. So if my goal is to encourage my peers that they can go out and they can run for office, I felt like it was a bigger platform for me to run for the General Assembly. And the issues that I think that my hometown is plagued with, I feel like they can only be addressed at the General Assembly level and not at the city level right now. I feel like we need to come from a top-down approach, because right now we can't trust our city government to fix themselves right now. So that's why I decided to run in this General Assembly election, specifically for the 16th District. I think that we need to reform local government from the top, including implementing at-large seats on our city council in Petersburg. And I, of course, would talk to the other localities and see how they like their city government ran. I'm definitely not trying to oppose at-large seats on every city council. I know that's actually not the norm in Virginia, but I think is what we need in Petersburg, Virginia right now, and we do need a solution for our problem.
Yeah, you mentioned Petersburg. You grew up there. You went to Petersburg High School. Were you Robert E. Lee High School?
Elementary school. Yes.
But Petersburg is probably the most fiscally troubled locality in Virginia.
Absolutely.
And what do you think the state government or you as a citizen can do to assist Petersburg to dig itself out of that hole?
Well, like I said, we need accountability. That's why I'm pushing for at-large elections, because if we can't hold our council members accountable, right, then how can we expect them to make different decisions that won't lead us in, to the same problems? I think too many of our council members are driven by self-interest and not driven by the interest of the city as a whole. And how can we even expect them to be driven by the issues of the city as a whole if they're not elected by the city as a whole? Not even the mayor is elected by the city as a whole. So if they can go hide in their neighborhoods and get their, you know, 10 neighbors around them to continue to support them, even though they might not be acting in the best interest of the city, I think that's a problem. So even if we were to keep single member districts on our council, I think we need at least one at-large seat to be able to represent the city as a whole so that we can hold that person accountable at the ballot box if we are not satisfied with the direction of the city. Like you said, we have one of the worst financial crises of really what led me to run a couple years ago when we had our problem. I decided things are not going to change unless we get some new energetic blood. And when I talk to my peers back home, they don't know really what's going on. They only see the bad results of what's happening. So, you know, what could I do to inform them of what's going on besides get involved myself and encourage them to also get involved? And everything that I learn, I just make sure I just spread the truth as much as possible and hold our elected officials in the city accountable so that they can't make those decisions to line their own pockets at the detriment of our city.
If you have one, what is your animating political philosophy? What makes you tick?
What makes me tick? I don't like politicians not taking full consideration of their constituents. Even if I meet a politician that I disagree with on some policy issues, if I understand that they are properly representing their constituents and their constituents' interests may differ from my constituents, then I think that it should remain a level of respect there. But anytime where I feel like you have a situation, maybe like my opponent right now, or Elliot's opponent, where you're more beholden to the party leaders and not your constituents, where, well, you're going to be implementing policies that benefit out-of-towners. So why are you representing a group of constituents if you don't have their best interests in mind? You know, that's what really make me tick. And I know they say, well, you know, you got to climb up the ladder so you can do the little stuff that nobody sees. No, I want you at the bottom of the ladder doing things that people see. That's what we need more of, more grassroots, homegrown politicians. So I cannot properly encourage that unless I, you know, put my money where my mouth is and run.
Thinking about both Virginia politicians, political leaders, elected officials, or national leaders, is there somebody that you can identify who you disagree with on the issues, but you still admire them or respect them for what they do or how they do it?
John Kasich. I admire John. I respect him for, you know, his opposition to Trump during the 2016-2017. You know, when he first started to oppose Trump policies, it was a lot more people like Mitt Romney and other Republicans. But I like the fact that he did not sway. He really stuck to his own value, morals and values, and I see the same thing inside him today, 2019, that I did in 2016. So I think that would be a national figure that I can relate to. I'm always going to give my own thanks to Senator Yvonne Miller, the late Senator Yvonne Miller. She taught me so much, but I actually seen her integrity. And it was just unmatched to any other politician I've ever worked for or witnessed, really. So I would want to be like Senator Miller, and that's what I'm trying to be like right now.
Well, that's a good role model. One other question is, you're running as an independent against a party candidate. What do independents bring to the table, regardless of the policy issues that you're concerned with? What can you do as an independent candidate that you might not be able to do as a Democrat or a Republican?
Well, I can definitely utilize, you know, the leverage of being in the middle of a evenly split house. But even more than that, we was talking about this earlier, I like campaigning, going up to doors and being able to introduce myself as an independent and not as a Republican or Democrat, which, you know, depending on which house you walk up to, you might get told to walk right back to the street. So it really allows me to talk about the real issues that people face once you don't have that label on your back. And what you will find is that many people agree on what needs to be done. So I think that you know, our party politics really gets in the way of good legislation and good representation of our communities.
And your opponent has a lot more money in his campaign account than you do. How do you plan to reach out to voters between now and November 5th?
Well, I'm going to try to do what I've been doing, is walking around, knocking on doors, focusing on areas that might rather have somewhat young, fresh blood in the party. I also look at the primary results and kind of compare and contrast them to historic results in my district, and trying to be very strategic in, you know, who I target while I'm canvassing. And also, I'm still, you know, I still have time to fundraise. We still have a month left. People usually pay attention during the last 30 days, the majority of the people. So I definitely want to utilize that time, spend a couple money to get to those areas and let people know I'm not the richest person in this race, but I am the one that's most committed to my community. And I think that I am the one that the district should really trust to represent their interests.
The 16th District covers a lot of territory, so you're going to be walking a lot of miles, knocking on doors and such.
Yeah, I guess so, but that's how I really should be. I have to get out to meet the constituents and make sure that they know exactly who they're voting for, because we need to stop the practice of going to the ballot box and voting for D's and R's. You know, I think we have two races on the ballot this year in my district, that, or in my city at least, that have party designation. So I'm proud to see that. And in both of those races, you know, it's a Democrat running against an independent. So that's effectively, you know, I guess you can bring some party people out, that, but just the fact that it's not a Republican running against a Democrat, I think that you won't see the same old fights that you see in other parts of the Commonwealth.
Well, Waylon Ross, thank you for joining us on The Score from Bering Drift. We'll be following your campaign and see what the results are in November.
Thank you so much, and thank you for interviewing me. Nice talking to you.
You're welcome. Thanks.
You're listening to The Score from Bering Drift with your host, Rick Sincere.
Another independent candidate for the General Assembly is Elliot Harding, who has been a guest on The Score on several previous occasions. He's challenging incumbent Democrat Cree Deeds in the bizarrely shaped 25th State Senate District. I asked Elliot about the qualities that independent candidates bring to politics.
Elliot, we just came from an independent candidates forum. You and Waylon Ross is running in the 16th District. You're in the 25th District. How did this event come about?
You know, I reached out to Waylon a couple weeks ago when I saw some news that Terry McAuliffe and Dick Saslaw were going to host a fundraiser to bail out Joe Morrissey's campaign debt, and I was really disheartened to see the Democratic establishment throw their weight behind Joe, because I thought, you know, Waylon actually would benefit Petersburg and the 16th District better than Joe would. He used to work with Democratic legislators. I figured that the Democratic establishment would have let the dust settle where it would lie, but then they got involved, and that frustrated me, because I've seen party politics for a long time. I've been a part of it. I've intentionally left it for that type of a reason, because sometimes the right thing that needs to be done isn't always done in the name of partisanship. It's something that, honestly, my opponent is actually a part of. He's right number two with Dick Saslaw, and I know that must have been an institutional choice. So I reached out to Waylon and I said, look, I'd love to bring you up to Charlottesville. You know, we have a lot of issues that overlap, a lot of policy platform issues that overlap, and, you know, I'll do my best to try to promote you, and we can kind of have a forum. We could go on maybe some local media and really elevate your cause and your issue in a way that you can use back in Petersburg. And he was all about it, and he was nice enough to make the trip, and we've had a great day. We did some media earlier today. We had this forum, and we're able to really touch on some very, very important issues that kind of go by the wayside in Virginia. Virginia political discussion.
The two districts you're running in are very different demographically, geographically. 25th district is largely rural, except for Charlottesville. The 16th district is urban, suburban, a little bit of rural. How did the two of you approach the two districts in different ways?
Well, you know, Virginia is unique in the sense that even though a district, when it's cut out this way, it's both are very gerrymandered, but there are overlap issues. You know, you mentioned Petersburg and Charlottesville. Petersburg's dealing with much different issues than Charlottesville as far as they lost a lot of manufacturing back in the day. The schools are much more significantly, not deteriorating, but he mentioned going to an unaccredited high school. These are the types of things that our area hasn't had to deal with. But, you know, there was a lot of history out of the Petersburg area, and our district has a lot of history, too. And that's something that he's a big history buff. And we were talking about Charlottesville. We were talking about Albemarle. We were talking about Lexington. And Petersburg really got its fame, you know, at the beginning of the Commonwealth. And so that's something that had a huge overlap, was our history. And we bonded as Virginians, and we said, look, you know, you've got Richmond and Petersburg. Charlottesville's our most dense population here. What can we do as far as talking about progressing minority business development? That's a topic of hot discussion here in Charlottesville. Criminal justice reform, law enforcement interaction with the black community, fixing our schools and promoting skills. These are things that are worthy of discussion no matter what district you're in. But there are also discussions you see in the rural parts of the 25th. In the 25th, a lot of in the rural areas, they're promoting skill-based jobs. They want to see that because and agricultural development as well. That's something we didn't really get to touch on. But south of Petersburg, you get into very rural areas. His neighboring districts are very rural, and ag is big there too. So there was a lot of overlap there as well. And ultimately, we're generational. We're the exact same age. And so we kind of have a perspective against the parties and the party dominance here in Virginia that really bonded us as well.
I asked Waylon this question too, and that is, what can you bring to the table as an independent, regardless of the issues that you're dealing with, but what can an independent candidate and an independent elected official do in the face of the two major political parties?
Well, practically and realistically speaking, you know, we go in there not having pledged ourselves to any particular caucus. We're going to get punished for it at the beginning. We just know that. They're not going to put us on the committees that we might necessarily want. We're not going to get the institutional money and support. So we might get blackballed for a little bit. But as we were saying during our forum, there's a certain degree of leverage in this very evenly split Commonwealth. And if one of us wins, in all likelihood, it'll throw the Senate into a 20-19 split, where they might be coming to us, and if it's both of us win, it'll probably be 19-19-2, which would be even more fun. But the party leadership would inherently have to be coming to us looking for a key vote and to go in a particular direction. Now, the Democrats would have an advantage if it came down to a tie because of the lieutenant governor's position, but ultimately speaking, I think we can leverage our independence. They're going to want us to caucus in order to have a secure majority, and we'd be able to really put our district's issues to the forefront in order to get passage. And I think that that's a sign of strength rather than just towing the party line and trying to feed into some platform that we might not agree with.
If you and Waylon Ross both win, will you have to flip a coin to decide who's the leader of the independent caucus?
No, we're both too independent for that. We'll both have our own and the other guy can join. But ultimately, I think that we would have a lot of fun doing that. I think that there are a lot of issues we would champion together. And then we'd probably find a lot of allies in the House of Delegates who might be partisan, but there are a lot of Republicans I know that are probably looking to break away on particular issues. I know that there are a lot of Democrats that are looking to break away. Something I always highlight is Nick Freitas carried Sally Hudson's ranked choice voting bill. Both of those two individuals are looking to break up the partisan stranglehold. If Waylon and I get elected, that's going to be a sign that that stranglehold is falling away. And I think that we can finally start to pierce through this veil that both parties have had in Virginia. They have a stranglehold, and it's extreme partisanship, and it's really pulling the fabric of our communities apart.
Do you think that there are certain issues that party-affiliated elected officials would rather not talk about, but that if you're in the General Assembly, they'll be forced to talk about it, or would they will feel liberated enough to talk about it?
I mean, I know for a fact they're going to have to talk about the things that we want to talk about, because we're going to be on the House or the Senate floor, grabbing the microphone and asking for a point of privilege to speak on behalf of criminal justice reform. Waylon and I both agree with the legalization of cannabis in Virginia, and there's we could spend all day talking about the different policy points as to why it should be done. And we'll do a tag team event up there talking about how it's fiscally responsible and it's also socially just to move forward and create the jobs and assist people that need the help and restore some justice into the communities that have been ravaged by the criminalization of that. That's an issue that I think is at the tip of the spear, but you've got an old guard, actually just based on age and status quo, that don't want to see those laws change. Waylon and I aren't afraid to do that. We're both 29. You know, my opponent's been in office longer than I've been alive. And as I said inside, if things were going to be changed by him, they would have already been changed. And it just hasn't happened yet. And so if I get in there, that's just one issue. But, you know, schools, skills, jobs, criminal justice system, all of these things are things that I know I'll elevate, and I expect Waylon will as well.
During the forum, there was some discussion about a link between drug law reform, cannabis legalization, and funding schools.
Right.
Could you elaborate on that a bit?
Well, sure. And so I know I referenced the drug reform for the funding of schools. I also referenced the expansion of particular forms of gaming as a source of revenue. I'll mention this. I think that the cannabis revenues should be directly appropriated in the criminal justice and mental health system. And I think that sports and poker should probably be legalized here in Virginia, because we're seeing around $3 billion of revenues lost to Maryland, Delaware, Pennsylvania, West Virginia, New Jersey. And then the Pamunkey tribe is probably going to put a $600 million casino in the middle of New Kent County. At the end of the day, that's a lot of revenues that we can use for particular direct sources. So I think cannabis revenues, we spent $63 million last year in arresting 29,000 people at a 20-year high on marijuana arrests. We could have brought in around $200 million in revenues over that same amount if legal. So that's a $263 million swing that could easily be used to expand the amount of beds that we have in our mental health system, to expand the use of body cams and public defenders, and have ulterior sentences and pretrial detention and home monitoring. Everybody says it's too costly to do these things, but when we find $263 million in a balanced budget state, it's like stumbling on a blank check, and we should be using it to fix our criminal justice system. Same with the gaming being directly appropriated into our schools. You know, the Virginia Lottery for a very long time was considered a source of funds for our schools. I think that we should directly appropriate other forms of gaming revenues and put them into our schools as well.
My last question, are you aware of other independent candidates for the General Assembly, and are you in communication with them?
There are others. I am not in communication with them. I'd be happy to do that. I know that there are third-party candidates. There are independent candidates. Ultimately, we looked at a map, and we were looking at folks that were independents running in a two-person race, the way that I am, the way that Waylon is. And we identified Waylon. I saw Waylon running in this race several months ago. I was encouraged to see it. He got on the ballot around the same exact time I did, turning in petitions on the last day. And, I'd be happy to speak with any independents out there, but I'm happy to have partnered up and promoted Waylon today. I think he did a really great job in Charlottesville. I know that He brought a lot of positive and collaborative perspective, and I really hope that we can have that opportunity to work together in Richmond.
Well, Elliot Harding, thanks again for joining us on The Score from Berwick Drift. I think this is your fifth appearance, so yeah. You've become a regular.
Yeah, I love what you do. I love what you stand for. I love The Score, and hopefully folks can, I'll say this. I'll put in a plug. Harding4VA.com. If someone wants to donate, that is where to go. So thank
and that's
you so
where
much.
The other independent candidates can find you.
Yeah. Or anybody who just doesn't want to see my opponent stay in his, 15th term in office or something. So, yeah, at the end of the day, if you want to support our race, that's where you can find us. And then you can find us on Facebook at Harding for State Senate and on Twitter at Harding4VA.
We'll be looking for you there. Thank you again, Elliot.
Thanks.
It's great to see you.
The Score is produced by Bering Drift, Virginia's top site for news and politics. To learn more, visit beringdrift.com.
First-year University of Virginia student Austin Hout has been getting a lot of press attention for a project he launched this past summer with friends from West Potomac High School. They started a nonprofit called Homoglobin with the goal of ending the Food and Drug Administration's 30-year-old policy that effectively bans gay men from donating blood. I met Austin on UVA's grounds last Wednesday and asked him to explain what Homoglobin is and what it does.
What is Homoglobin? What's its mission?
So our mission is basically to fight for more equality for the LGBTQ community, mostly in healthcare and education. And a big part of that is fighting to change the FDA's discriminatory blood donation policy that says that if you're gay or bisexual and you've had sex with another man in the last year, you can't donate blood.
And that's an old policy. And frankly, I thought it had been rescinded a long time ago. Can you tell me the history of that and how it came about and what's happened most recently?
Yeah. So about in the mid-80s, in the height of the AIDS epidemic and the big scare that was going on, everybody was like, well, it's too much work and we know too little about it. We're just going to ban all of them from donating blood. And that's how it was for 25, 30 years. And then in 2015, I think it was December of 2015, the FDA, they made a change that said, oh, well, now it's no longer a lifetime ban, it's a year-long deferral. But if we're being honest, that's a de facto ban still, because you have to abstain for a year, and very few people do that. And then still to this day, they've been thinking about doing 3 months, and I think last year they commissioned some sort of study that's supposed to begin this fall that measures like the risk activities of people who have had sex within the last 3 months, which leads me to believe they're thinking about a 3-month policy. Our job is to push them even more towards that and say, hey, other countries, Britain, Canada, have moved to a 3-month deferral, and I think we should too. That's the first step.
And how did you discover this issue? Among all the possible issues you could be an activist for, how did this one come to your attention?
Well, I discovered it for two reasons. So I'm like a total policy nerd, and I was like, I just like looking through Wikipedias and TED Talks and whatnot. And I was going down the Wikipedia rabbit hole, and I was scrolling through different nations' policies towards the LGBTQ community, and I was mostly looking at like, oh, well, Eastern Europe, and like they're horrible towards the LGBTQ community. But here in the United States, you know, it's so surprising, like, you know, here in Virginia, you can get fired for being gay or trans. But the blood deferral controversy caught my eye. I was like, wait, this is still a thing? I'm like, 30 years ago, maybe, but like now. So I did some research into it, and I was like, oh my God, wait. This is, out of all the different issues, this is like the most accessible to the public. So that's why I chose this specific issue and the issues that surround it, LGBTQ inclusive, sex ed, and history curriculums, and affordable and reliable access to STI testing, prevention, and treatment.
And Homoglobin as an organization is a 501c4 educational organization?
Yeah, it's a social welfare organization.
So could you walk me through the process of how you started it and, you know, what kind of legal hoops did you have to go through, that sort of thing?
Yeah, there were a lot. So I believe the first step was filing with the State Corporation Commission. So we had to file and incorporate as a corporation under the Virginia Nonstock Corporation Act, I believe. And then we had to basically tell the IRS, like, hey, we have intent to operate as a nonprofit organization, so we had to, you know, create a bunch of budgets, and of course it's total guesstimation. Like, we cannot know at all because we have no prior financial history. And we had to file with the Virginia Department of Consumer Services, which allows us to solicit contributions without getting a penalty. And so I think all in all, out of pocket, it was quite a bit of money. I'm filing for trademark sometime this week. Mm-hmm. So that obviously we can retain our name, which I'm not too worried about, but, you know, just in case, it's good.
It's good to have that.
Yes.
And what kind of budget do you have? What are you operating under?
So our budget right now, because we are still in the kind of build-up phase of, like, getting people on the ground, which is set to end at the end of this month. So we're actually coming up really close to our first phase, but we are going to start, and we're hopefully going to be paying our campus ambassadors by maybe December or January. But a lot of that budget is probably going to be, we're going to be making, if we have just our four campus ambassadors and no other income from donations, which we're hoping we're going to get online donations, and because we invested in this donor list, and it's people who have contributed to similar causes, but we're, with nothing else, just the campus ambassadors, $6,000 a month, which is quite a bit,
mm-hmm.
right? So we have a lot to work with already. We have a little bit of cash on hand, but we're trying to be kind of conservative about where we spend it and whatnot, and be financially responsible.
Now, how long ago did you start thinking about this, and how long did it take to get to the point where you got your IRS status and
yeah.
And to the point where you are now?
So the idea came probably in early to mid-July, and I was talking with my friend Ian about it. He's my best friend. We have done, like, basically everything together since ninth grade. And he was like, why don't we start, like, a nonprofit or something? And I said, you're crazy. And then, like, a few days later, after thinking about it, I was like, you might be onto something. Let's look into this. And so I started working, like, pretty much around the clock, and we got our nonprofit status and launched on August 19th.
Oh, well, so you really recently.
Yes.
It's basically a month and a half.
Yes, and we have been basically, I think what sets us apart from a lot of other organizations is two big things. One, it's very much a passion project for all of us, so none of us want to be paid right now.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to make sure we have a secure financial base. And so we're moving very, very quickly in our setup process. And the second big thing is that it's very congregational. We are all in it together, and none of us are professionals, which is a big thing that sets us apart. And I think some people would argue, like, oh, that's a detriment. Like, oh, you want professionals on your team, yada, yada. But I think a big part of what makes our organization work at the current moment is the fact that we're all friends, and we want to get things done not because it's our professional job, but because we want to help out our friends and make an actual difference.
And you can always go to professionals for advice if you need
it. Yes, absolutely. We have saved so much money already. Like, I was like, oh no, to be able to file all these forms, like, I'm going to need a lawyer probably. And I was like, oh, am I going to need to spend $1,000? No. I was working over the summer as an intern for Scott Surivel. I don't know if you know him. Yeah,
mm-hmm.
State Senator up in Northern Virginia. And he has a law firm. And so that's where the office was. And so I just went downstairs and asked one of the other lawyers, help me for 30 minutes pro bono.
Yeah, that's part of his job.
Exactly.
And so what kind of activities are you engaged in? Are you planning on sending letters to the FDA, congressional testimony, going to the General Assembly? What kind of things do you have in mind?
So we're going to – it's like we're looking at it, like, holistically. Step one is obviously, you know, a big reason why it hasn't changed is because they simply have no incentive to change it because it's so little known. The issue, like, nobody knows about it. Less than half of people know their own blood type, let alone knowing the intricacy of the FDA's blood deferral policy. So our main objective right now, what we can do right now, is educate the public about the issue, which we've been doing. We're posting every day. We have, other countries' policies on not just the blood deferral policy, but on different curricula as well. I have been in talks with another state senator. Oh my God, and I'm Chap Peterson,
mm-hmm.
Up in Northern Virginia as well. And the reason why we contacted him was because he is on the Health and Education Committee in the Virginia State Senate. And so I reached out to him and I said, hey, I'd like to work with you on a bill that leads to inclusive LGBTQ sex ed and or history classes in our schools, which I looked at the Virginia Code. It actually would not be that difficult. You add a couple of words to the end of one of the sentences and you change it. So we are doing that. And then the reason why earlier I said that it is the most accessible issue, one of the most accessible issues for people, is because so the committee that deals with the deferral policy on the national level, the Blood Products Advisory Committee for the FDA, they have a meeting every year in March in Silver Spring. And not only is it close, but you can ask beforehand and interested members of the public can not only attend, but can give a presentation there as well. So come March, we very hopefully will be making our case in front of a bunch of medical professionals and saying, hey, look, I know that like you're unsure and every population of every country is different. And so you can't just solely rely on what other countries do. But I said, you know, like you have to think about the statistics that show even with the people who were admitted from reducing it from lifetime to 1 year, there are still just under 300,000 pints of blood estimated that the FDA turns away annually that could be utilized. And I think they say that at the very least, each pint can help two people. Mm-hmm. So that's at least 600,000 people that it could potentially help.
How much blood is collected in the United States in every year? Do you have any idea?
I don't know the exact number. The only number that I have, I can definitely tell you that there's always a shortage.
Right.
There's articles, it seems like, every month that Red Cross, short on blood. And so we haven't really been public about this, but earlier on, before we launched, I ran this study based on I wanted to sort of confirm the results of another 2008 study. 2008 study was trying to find a genetic basis for homosexuality, which people have been trying to do for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
And they have come up with different answers and whatnot. And so they were basically, what they were doing is they got self-proclaimed heterosexual men and women and self-proclaimed homosexual men and women, and they compared a bunch of physical traits like hair color, eye color, height, yada, yada, yada. And so the biggest indicator was blood type, surprisingly, and the sample size wasn't great, but it seemed to suggest that gay men, and to a lesser extent gay women, but especially gay men, were more likely to have O blood and more likely to have negative blood. And so I had two questions. One, does that hold up with a larger sample size? Two, does having a higher probability of O and negative mean necessarily O negative? So I ran a much larger study. We had the unfortunate number of 666 participants. And we found, I believe, the difference, if you looked at cisgender heterosexual men and cisgender gay men, the difference in chance was almost twice as much. They had almost twice the probability of having O negative blood as cisgender heterosexual men. I think the difference was 18.92% to 10.3%.
And you conducted this study on your own?
Yes.
You found the sample mm-hmm. participants?
So basically what I did was I promoted it to a bunch of people. We got basically a good distribution. Half of them roughly were heterosexual, and about half of them were non-heterosexual. and so when we looked across all of the statistics, pretty much across the board, it's more difficult with the trans community because genetics is, for them, are wildly different. But simply looking at the cisgender community, pretty much across the board, gay men, lesbian women, bisexual men and women, even asexuals, which is kind of interesting. I need to confirm the results, so we're going to do an even bigger survey. But the bottom line is, going along with this hypothesis, the FDA is not only using a discriminatory rule and ruling out pretty much a blanket ban on a very diverse group of people with wildly different sexual practices. Not only are they making it discriminatory, but they could be turning away a population that is even more likely to have the very blood that they're always short on.
That's really interesting. We're running short on time. I just want to ask whether you think this very ambitious project that you've embarked on could result in academic credit at some point.
Academic credit for?
For the work you're doing. Could you transform that into a grade here at the University of Virginia?
I haven't really thought about it. Mostly this is so I can feel like, because I look around and I see people like Greta Thunberg and all these people who are my age or younger, and they're so well connected and they are making so much of a difference. And I think to myself, because like I want to get into politics, I want to give back to the community. I'm like, how the heck are they doing it so well? And the answer always comes back to they went by, there's back where we're from, I don't know if you know the Travis Manion Foundation.
No, I'm not familiar with that.
At my high school, where I'm from, every year they would do this Travis Manion like Day of Service, and it's based on the quote, "If not me, then who?" Like you were saying earlier, if you want something right, you got to do it yourself, and if you want change to happen, you can't just wait. So, I haven't really been too concerned with like what I could translate it to. I think the personal pride in knowing that we were the ones who pushed the FDA to change, that we were the ones who got the state legislatures to act and change the curriculum, is more than enough pride.
And there's also the famous saying from Ronald Reagan, you can accomplish an awful lot if you don't care who gets the credit.
Yeah, I will agree with that. I very much am a supporter of everybody in my organization. We have titles, and there's a hierarchy, but we're all equal.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd say even a volunteer at like ODU, if they had a question for me, they could call me at any time, and I'm either in class asleep or I will answer them. So, I very much my own personality. It's very new to being me, being a boss and like telling people what to do, and I don't want to be a boss. I want to be a leader, and I think there's a big difference.
There is a difference, yeah, definitely. Yeah. Final question, how can people find out more? What's your website address? Are there other channels of communication they can use?
Yeah, there are. So if you want to see what the press has been saying about us so far, you can pretty much just Google hemoglobin. I think the Washington Post used something that the AP News used, which the AP News derived it from, I believe, the Daily Progress article, and there's plenty of news sources about us. Our website is www.homoglobin.org, and our email, if anybody has any questions, is homoglobininfo@gmail.com, I believe. And on the website, if people feel like they are qualified or would like to participate in our organization as like an employee or volunteer, there's a page to like get involved. There are different job opportunities, and if they want to make a contribution, if they don't have the time to become a volunteer or an employee, we have a donation system that's either one time or monthly, and like literally anything would be appreciated, because like I said towards the beginning, every dollar is super important, and we're operating on a very tight budget.
Are you on social media? Facebook, Twitter, LinkedIn?
We are. So currently we're working on our Facebook, but our Instagram and Twitter are both at @homo_globin.
Okay, well, we'll be finding that. Austin, good to talk to you. I'm glad to see somebody ambitious and hardworking here at the University of Virginia.
Yeah.
Thank you for joining us on The Score from Bering Drift, and I'm sure we'll be hearing from you in the future.
Oh, thank you so much, sir.
Did you miss a previous episode of The Score? Look for our podcast at BeringDrift.com.
Last week on The Score, we had a wide-ranging conversation with Young Voices contributor and law student Ethan Lamb about the Democratic presidential candidates. This week, we finish up with a look at the Republican challengers to President Trump and possible Libertarian Party candidates. Here's Ethan Lamb.
Let's switch gears, look at the other side, which there's not much to look at, but the Republican Party overwhelmingly likes President Trump. He's got 88% approval among Republicans. My theory is that's because so many people have left the Republican Party since he got the nomination in 2016. So there are fewer Republicans in that universe that Gallup is asking questions of. But three major candidates have emerged against him. Former Governor Bill Weld of Massachusetts, former Governor Mark Sanford of South Carolina, and one-term Congressman Joe Walsh, who is actually going after Trump from the right rather than the traditional conservative. The Republican Party is guaranteeing Trump's renomination by ending primaries. In the state of Virginia, where I'm from, they're having a convention which guarantees that only Trump delegates will be selected. What's your assessment of that whole scenario? Do you think that any of those candidates can pull a Pat Buchanan or Eugene McCarthy against Trump in New Hampshire?
I think that, everyone's really governed by negative polarization at this point. So to answer the first question, I think that the reason that his approval rating is so high is not necessarily what he's done, but who is opposing him. And Democrats are increasingly unpalatable. I think that it's not too surprising that he has the support that he does. I think that Bill Weld, I haven't really heard all too much from him in the past month or so. I think that he's taken a few unpopular stances within the conservative movement. I think especially his stance on life. I believe he's pro-choice. A couple other positions that I think it would just make him, you know, a little too unpalatable for the conservative movement at this point. And Joe Walsh is another one that I don't think has any realistic chance either. He has the precise problem that Trump has, especially with his rhetoric. If you look at his old tweets, that he's said some pretty racially incendiary things over the course of the past few years. And a lot of the concerns about Trump are at a character level. And you can't on one hand say that you're not going to vote Trump because you disagree with his character, and on the other hand vote for someone like Joe Walsh. And that brings us to Sanford. Sanford, while he has that you know, tremendous controversy regarding his tenure as governor with the affair and everything, but I think he has done a pretty good job to repent. I think that he definitely has probably the best shot of anyone at this point in getting any real ground on Trump. I think that he's like a regular Tea Party conservative. I think he was actually in the Freedom Caucus, I believe. And he just carries himself with a much better demeanor than Trump, so I don't think that any of them are serious challengers will even take a state away from Trump, but I think the Mark Sanford does, especially now, I think stands the best chance. I think that had you asked me a year ago, I probably would have said someone like Ben Sasse ran, and then he might have done some real damage to the Republican Party or you know, might have saved the Republican Party, depending on who you asked. But now it doesn't look like anyone with any serious background is going to contest Trump.
Just by the fact that Sanford was able to get back his old congressional seat after the scandals of his governorship shows that he was able to rehabilitate himself.
Yeah, absolutely, and he's done a great job, and he conducts himself pretty humbly, and he's an actual conservative. So it depends on where the conservative movement is. It seems like a lot of them now at least belie their principles from just 18 months ago regarding tariffs, regarding other kind of pressing issues, entitlement reform. I think that it depends on how serious the Tea Party movement was to begin with, if they were just in opposition to Obama, or whether they did actually have some profound principles, especially regarding entitlement reform. If that's the case, then yeah, he could definitely get a good contingent there, but I don't think that Republicans really have the appetite to address those issues, unfortunately.
Now, of two of those three challengers to Trump, Bill Weld and Mark Sanford, they have libertarian leanings, and there's talk that if they don't damage Trump enough to get the Republican nomination, they may seek the Libertarian nomination. Two other names that have come up are Justin Amash of Michigan, who left the Republican Party on the 4th of July, declaring his independence, and, surprisingly enough, former Governor Lincoln Chafee of Rhode Island, who's a registered Libertarian now after formerly being a Republican, an Independent, and a Democrat. I don't know whether you know him enough about Libertarian Party politics, but could you comment on those four people possibly entering the race for president as a libertarian, what effect would they have on the Libertarian Party, and what effect could they have in the general election if any one of them got the nomination rather than the current crop of libertarian presidential wannabes who are all people who have never been elected to public office at all?
Yeah, well, this could just be my ignorance speaking. I'm not all too familiar with the gentleman from Rhode Island, but I will say about Justin Amash is that he has the ability to kind of mainstream the Libertarian Party. I think that he was a relatively popular Tea Party Republican over the past few years, and he kind of engenders a lot of excitement, especially in the young libertarian crowd. I think that now elections are increasingly, it's increasingly important to kind of have a social media profile to reach younger voters. I think Justin Amash, just speaking anecdotally with people I know, really excites a lot of conservative or libertarian-minded people. I think that if he were to run as a libertarian, it would definitely take a lot more of the Republicans than of the Democrats, because I think that he's functionally what a Republican was 5 years ago, barring some issues on foreign policy and whatnot. But again, yeah, he's kind of really speaks about constitutional conservatism and entitlement reform and tax policy. I think that's some issues that the Republican Party is kind of not really focused on at the moment. They're more focused on immigration and stuff of that nature. So I think that I think Justin Amash is the one person who I think that could do some serious damage to Trump's presidency.
It's interesting. Justin Amash represents the same central Michigan district that Gerald Ford represented for decades before he became president. And he also outpolled Donald Trump in 2016 by 9 or 10 points. So he's got some legs there.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I've been looking into his race. I take issue or question at the very least why he decided to leave the Republican Party rather than reform it from within, because from what it looks like to me is that he's kind of just reduced the influence that libertarians have on the Republican Party in general, and I don't think that helps out many people unless he is running as a libertarian from here on out.
Well, so, you know, talking to some members of Congress recently, Republicans, both privately and publicly, they will say that Congress is in dysfunction, and I can see how Justin Amash felt a lot of frustration at not only being in the minority with the Democrats in control, but also his Republican caucus no longer staying true to its principles that got him elected to Congress in 2010.
Yeah, absolutely. And look, it may be ethically justified. I'm not sure it would help him as a politician, especially if he ran again for Congress, which I think he will be doing, unless he's running for presidency, of course. I think that, he would be close to being primaried if he were to run as a Republican, so I kind of get that. And I'm not too familiar with his popularity within his district, but yeah, no, it's absolutely ethically justified as to why he left the Republican Party. I see it as a stance to elevate his name recognition, and I think that, yeah, that could help him definitely with the Libertarian candidacy.
Well, what's interesting about Libertarian Party politics is that you don't have to run a two-year campaign to get the nomination. When Bob Barr, the former congressman from Georgia, decided to run as a Libertarian in 2008, he declared he was a candidate 3 weeks before the convention. The Libertarian Party conventions are wide open, Wild West phenomena, and so I think any of these people or persons unknown could get the nomination without even announcing their candidacy until, you know, sometime in April or May of 2020. Any final comments on what the presidential election season looks like, and then we can wrap things up?
Yeah, I think the most pressing issue, definitely the most confounding factor, I would say, is how the state of the economy heading into the 2020 election. I think that if the economy is still robust and still working for the American people as it's doing right now, I think that that's really Trump's only pitch. I think if once the economy collapses, then the entire argument that that they should be in charge and that we should stand by Trump as Republicans, conservatives, libertarians really falls apart. So I think that's the most confounding factor.
Yeah, and there are a lot of farmers who are already feeling the pinch of a recession that the rest of us are not yet feeling.
Yeah.
Well, Ethan, thank you for joining us today on the Score from Bering Drift. I hope we have a chance to talk again maybe in February around the time of the New Hampshire primary.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you for having me.
Do you have an idea for future episodes of The Score? Write to host Rick Sincere at ricksincere@gmail.com.
That's all the time we have this week on The Score. For all the writers and editors at Bering Drift, I'm Rick Sincere. Be sure to come back next week for more news, reviews, and interviews. Tell your friends where to find us, and feel free to leave comments and suggestions on our website at beringdrift.com. We'll be looking for you.
Have an idea for future episodes of The Score? Write to host Rick Sincere at ricksincere@gmail.com. The Score is produced by Bering Drift, Virginia's top site for news and politics. To learn more, visit beringdrift.com.